Abanasso. This afternoon we'll put to the test of experience a hypothesis that is quite core to Buddhist philosophy, and now very specifically to this Sautrantika philosophy, which I'll call, let's say, classical Buddhist philosophy. It's not the deepest level, but it's a very practical level. It's not so esoteric, so subtle, that it doesn't engage with our lives. In fact, this does engage with our lives. And here's the hypothesis. The hypothesis is a response to the question, who do you think you are? Who do you think you are? Jijo, who do you think you are? You know, that can be asked in some, who do you think you are? Tracy, who do you think you are? You know, all in the intonation, right? But there's the question, who do you, and it really, the articulation, I think, is just perfect. Who do you think you are? Right? And here's the response to that question, this hypothesis, and it's about our experience, so you can test whether this hypothesis stands up to your own critical investigation or not, but you won't get there by thinking about it a lot. You'll get there by probing into it a lot, like Galileo didn't figure out there were moons around Jupiter by just thinking really hard about Jupiter. So here's the hypothesis. The hypothesis is that we have an innate, that is, it's called lenge. We are born with it. So you can't blame your parents or society or anybody else. Born with it. Right? You are born with a mental affliction. That is a whole host of them. But one of them is a delusional sense of who you are. And that is the assertion, of course, that it's delusional. The sense here is that, I'll speak first person, that number one, I am, of course I am, and I actually am, but not only am I, but I, the Tibetan term is rangyatupa, and that rangyatupa, I can stand on my own, rangyatupa, gyawa means to uphold, and rang means self, and tupa means be able. Can stand on your own. Who are you? Are you a jellyfish? Are you a wimp? Are you just a follower? Or can you stand on your own? Rangyatupa. And then Zeyu. Are you really there? Are you just some kind of a fluffy bit of imagination? Are you really there or not? Speak, stand up and speak for yourself. Are you really there? Zeyu means, are you substantially there? Are you really there? Or are you just kind of some conceptual abstraction? Okay? Zeyu, substantially present. I'm in other words, I'm really here. Really be somebody. Okay? Rangyatupa zeyuki, da, self, me, individual, person. Now they flesh this out a little bit. And they're talking about our experience again that we already have. That is the hypothesis. Not that we'll get by becoming joining some delusional philosophical club or religion or what have you. And that is, they say, how do you relate to your body and mind? And that was the wording, and it was good wording, wasn't it? When I say, how do you relate to your body and mind, I didn't just say gibberish. So do you have a relationship? How do you view your body? Are you comfortable with your body? Well, that's a meaningful phrase if and only if you're not identical to your body. Because with means two things, right? So do you feel comfortable with your body? How do you feel about your body, right? So there's one. And then how do you feel about your mind? What do you think of your mind? You like it? Can you control it? Do you want to control it? And so your body, your mind. So now it looks like there's three of you there. You got a body. You have one. Only one. You have a mind. Many mental factors, but only one mind. And then there's you. So then now we ask the relationship, okay, now of course within the body there are many, many parts. Within the mind there are many, 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 many mental factors.
Attention, emotion, desires, and so forth. So there's a whole society there. So these are not two just single monolithic entities. Two kind of groups. The bundle of your body, bundle of your mind, and then there's you. So now the question is, how do you fit into that? And of course, the bundle of the body and mind are profoundly entangled, right? Really very intricately and related. Sometimes call it embodied mind, not bad. Okay? Or the Buddha himself said your body is the basis for that. Or in Buddhism, Dawe Tendi, or something like that. But the Dao Den, this basis of leisure, this basis of leisure, everybody who studied Chantadeva, Dao Den, the basis of leisure, the basis of a life of leisure and opportunity. It's a basis. It's your body. So, how do you relate? How do you, as an individual, one person there, how do you relate to this conglomerate of your body and the conglomerate of your mind, which are profoundly entangled with each other? And the metaphor given here, in terms of this hypothesis, is that it's like a group of merchants, or a consortium of merchants. And among the consortium, there's one who's the CEO, or the head merchant. And this one really is in charge. So in other words, you could call it a corporation, you know, with vice presidents and managers and all the way down to the, all the way up and all the way down. But when all is said and done, you have to say, when American English say the buck stops here, that is, there's the CEO. So if the company does really badly, then you blame the CEO, and if the company does really well, the CEO gets a raise. But the CEO, the chief operating chief, CEO, executive officer. Chief executive, nice term. Chief executive officer. You are the chief executive officer of the corporation of your body mind. Right? Which means that you can't act entirely autonomously. You're not entirely independent. There may be probably a board there. But nevertheless, when all is said and done, you're the CEO. And so that's a little bit that's modern terminology, but this is an old analogy. The chief merchant among a group of merchants, who really is in charge of the consortium. And so, there you are. So you're amongst them, but you're not identical with any of them. And yet you do have some real, how do you say, authority over them. You more than anyone else there. Okay? So that's the hypothesis. And of course the hypothesis is that although there is such a sense of being that person, that CEO, there is no such person. That there is the grasping onto the sense that I am, but when you look for the referent of that sense of personal identity, nowhere to be found. In other words, it's a delusional sense of personal identity. So, just to make that point really clear, because for some people this may be new, I'm going to give my silliest example, but then we move right on. But imagine something is not true, but imagine that I think some of you have heard this before. I know it's really silly, but I can live it. Imagine that I think that I am the incarnation of Napoleon Bonaparte. And I'm taking it really seriously. And I walk around speaking with a French accent, at least my best approximation. What would I be? And when you address me, I want you to say, mon général. Yeah. I want you to salute me. And if you don't, off with your head. You know, so I can be walking around really thinking that I am Napoleon Bonaparte. You know, come back to life and I make sure that, you know, you see my mudra. You've all seen the paintings, right? That way or one or the other. So I could be walking around thinking I'm Napoleon Bonaparte. And this can strongly influence my emotions and my behavior. And then if you show me respect as Napoleon, then I feel really happy. And if you think I'm a total idiot, that I'm, you know, that I'm not Napoleon at all, I'd be very upset. A French accent. And so, is there any Napoleon Bonaparte here? There's not even a shred of Napoleon Bonaparte. There's zero Napoleon Bonaparte. Nevertheless, I may be tenaciously clinging, but I am. So the grasping onto I am Napoleon Bonaparte, is it real or is it unreal?
It's real.
The sense that I am Napoleon Bonaparte, is it real or unreal?
Real.
It has efficacy. It's making me miserable. It's making me put my hand in my shirt, and so forth. It's making me speak with a French accent because, but je parle pas le français. What shall I do? Speak with a French accent. It's as close as I can get. So I'm doing all kinds of crazy things here because I think that I'm Napoleon Bonaparte. Is there a Napoleon Bonaparte here? No, not even a shred. Nothing. Right. So one thing is real, and the other it doesn't exist at all. Napoleon Bonaparte here doesn't exist at all, but the sense I am Napoleon, that is very real. So in a similar fashion, so there was a silly one, now we just set it aside, but to show one is real, the other one doesn't exist at all. And that is due, and here's the hypothesis, we really do grasp onto ourselves as that being that CEO of the corporation of body. And is there any such CEO? No. Not even a shred. That's the hypothesis. So now let's put it to the test of the experience. That's what we debated about when I was 38 years ago.
Think.
Now let's just put it to the test of experience. And it's very personal, up close and personal. Do you have that sense of grasping onto, I am the agent, I am the observer, something autonomous, I have a mind, I have consciousness. My consciousness gets dull, my consciousness gets clear, my consciousness gets agitated, my body gets too fat, too skinny, etc. My. In other words, you're describing your corporation. So, is there such a quasi-autonomous, controlling, real, substantial person? And also where the rubber really hits the road, really gets... I'm not going to choose any target here. Sometimes I'll say Jack and Jill, so you know I'm not meeting anybody. Okay, Jack. Jack, you're just ugly. You're just ugly. And Jack, yeah, my body's fat. So, Jack, you're just stupid. Yeah, my mind's not very right. You're quite right. Jack, I just find you disgusting. That. Insult my body if you like. You know, I just inherited it. I didn't know what I'm going to do. And insult my mind if you like. It arises then in my body. What can I do? But you got really personal when you just say, I find you disgusting. You know, you hit my body. And then you hit my mind. But then you really got to me. He said, I just find you disgusting. Here's the word I like. You're a real jerk. Your mind's okay, actually. And your body's just a body, but, you know, Jack, you. Jack. I'm not talking about your mind or your body. I'm not talking about you, the CEO. Jack, you're just a jerk. You're really just a jerk. And if there's anyone that says, you're talking to me? You're talking to me? I know you weren't talking to my body. You weren't talking to my mind. You're talking to me. I don't like that. Or likewise, now let's, you know, good cop, bad cop. Jack, I've met a lot of people in my time, but frankly, I just think you're the finest person I've ever met. I mean, you're just great. I mean, you're fabulous. I just stand in awe. I just find you amazing. You're just one spectacular human being. Just my hat's off to you. You're just incredible. Unbelievable. I mean, I've never met anyone like you. Just amazing. Anybody there? Kind of enjoying that? Because I didn't say a word about your body or your mind. I was talking about you. So is there any resonance? Does anything rise to the occasion? You know, it's like a fly fisherman. You throw out the fly. Does any fish come up and say, I'll take that? Yes, you're referring to me. And I don't like it. I do like it. Or Jack, I just find you boring. So now we'll check. Okay. Now, why would we check? Is it just a philosophical exercise, a psychological fun and games? And the assertion here is that mental afflictions is gradient upon gradient of gradient of mental afflictions. Even when you achieve shamatha, you're resting there in the substrate consciousness. While you're there, all of the mental afflictions associated with the desire realm, they're dropped. You're not in the desire realm anymore. You've crossed the threshold when you've achieved shamatha. You cross the threshold into the form, right? That's why it's called the access to the first jhana. So your cravings, your hostility, jealousy, pride, arrogance, everything, all the mental afflictions that arise within that bandwidth of the desire, they all fall asleep. They just go dormant, hibernating. When you're resting there in the substrate consciousness, enjoying the bliss, the luminosity, the non-conceptuality, does this mean that all your mental afflictions are gone? I like that luminosity. I like that place. I like that non-conceptuality. I don't want to let go. That's grasping. That's attachment. Subtler attachment. So there it is. There it is. Level upon level upon level. But there's a whole bandwidth of mental afflictions, and then all the ensuing misery, types of distress, anxiety, and so forth that arise from this particular dimension of delusional grasping onto oneself. Okay? There are subtler ones. Grasping onto oneself is an inherently existing entity. So that's subtle. That's quite deep. It's difficult even to identify clearly. But this one's easier. And to identify the sheer absence of this self, that Napoleon Bonaparte, then can cut right to the root of all the mental afflictions that arise from that level of delusion. And that can be very free, much more peaceful life, much more realistic life, much more relaxed life. All the craving, hostility, and so forth that come from that level of delusion, of grasping onto, I am the CEO of my corporation. That doesn't happen because the root has been cut. So, enough. Now let's put that to the test of experience. You do that by probing right into the core. First of all, establish your base. In relaxation, an inner calm of stability, clarity, settling body, speech, and mind in the natural state, calming the mind with mindfulness. Let your eyes be open. Evenly rest your awareness in the space in front of you. But without deliberately focusing on any object, external or internal. Just rest and be present in the present moment. Now let your interest, your attention, converge in upon your most intimate knowing, the most indubitable knowing. And that is your knowing right now. Awareness is occurring. The awareness of awareness itself. Intuitively, non-discursively, non-conceptually. Rest in that flow of being aware of being aware, knowing the knowing. Gently initiate the oscillation that we practiced earlier. Withdrawing your awareness quite forcibly, but not too forcibly, from all appearances. Right into that luminosity of awareness itself. Retreat from all appearances. At least relatively. And then release relatively into a space of non-objectivity. That is just releasing, but with no target, no reference. Accept the gentle continuity of awareness, of being aware. Invert and release at your own pace. See that your breath continues to flow utterly effortlessly, that you do not arouse your breath as you invert your awareness in upon itself, or expel the breath and you release. So it's let the breath flow in and out of us effortlessly. pleasure and virtue awareness. Penetrate a bit more deeply. And with discerning intelligence, with a question. And that is, you are doing something voluntarily. If you are doing it, nobody's making you do it. This inversion and release of awareness. You're doing it. So you must be the agent, right? You're controlling your mind. Directing your attention, like a CEO in a company. So when you invert your awareness, invert deeply. See if you can get a glimpse of your sense of who you are as the agent. Pull back the screen. Who do you think you are? You are in charge of your mind, controlling it, releasing and inverting it. Probe it really in depth. See what you see and then release once again. Inverting deeply in upon the very agent. And release. Bear in mind, we are looking for something that does exist. That is the hypothesis. An actual lived sense of being the agent who's in charge of your body, and in this particular case, in charge of your mind. When you invert, see what arises. We see what comes to mind. When you direct your awareness in upon your sense of being the agent, and you may think, I'm a pretty good meditator. On occasion you may feel, as a meditator, I'm a failure. I stink. Who are you referring to? As you invert your awareness, who is this meditator? Show your face. If some appearance comes to mind, ask of that appearance, is this I? Or is it merely an empty appearance, like a reflection in a mirror, like a mirage? probe even more deeply. Even when you're not doing anything, when you're just sitting there, as inactive as you can be. You have a sense of being the observer, someone in here, a noun, a person, an entity. Subject that is observing over here on the subjective side. Invert your awareness and invert it so deeply that you lift the veil on your sense of being the observer. And see what you see. And then release into objectless space, inverting and releasing as before. When you invert your awareness, if some appearance does come to mind, some impression, ask of that impression, is this really you? Is it really a person? Or is it simply an appearance? Now release the oscillation, release all effort. Let your awareness come to rest in the center, in its own place, holding its own ground, knowing itself. Here's one from the retreat. When I'm practicing settling the mind in its natural state, the usual fuzzy TV channel eventually appears about 3 meters in front of me. That's good, your parents trained you well not too close to it. After watching that a while, a thought often followed by
eventually arises, usually from one of my four main topics of rumination. Yes, thankfully, after 3 weeks, I have now whittled it down to four. In front, behind, the left, and the right. Okay. These, however, do not seem to arise and dissolve from the fuzzy TV channel, as you have described, but from a place where awareness seems to exist, somewhere within the seemingly true existent body labeled I. Are even my delusions a bit more confused than the average bearer? Well, I think we'd have to do a poll. That would be difficult to say. Well, maybe that just pertains to the point I made earlier this afternoon, and that is that mental afflictions arise from multiple levels, some of them utterly acquired, that we learn from other people. I think there's a little bit of data that could give rise to interesting discussion, but I don't believe that anybody's born a racist. I don't think so. I think we have to learn that one. There's just a lot of delusions that we acquire through life from various sources, without pointing fingers in any direction, and independence upon a delusion, like thinking that people of one's own country are somehow superior to people from other countries. How about that just generically? I am from Guatemala, we Guatemalans, whatever. So that's an acquired trait. Nobody's born that way. You have to acquire it. But then on the basis of that, then you can have a lot of mental addictions stemming from that particular delusion. So there's very acquired, very superficial, and then there's deeper, deeper, deeper until we get to the level that's conate. Conate means we're born with it. And even there are layers upon layers, right? And so likewise, there are layers and layers of sources of rumination. We can have rumination stimulated for just by hearing somebody else in conversation, quite superficial level. Rumination may be aroused as we start dredging the psyche through deeper, deeper shamatha practice. It starts to bring up older memories, emotions, desires, and so forth, and they'll just come with their own little parade of rumination. And then I would say, from my belief system, by my way of viewing reality, we can have rumination stemming from experiences from past life. And that's a pretty deep source. So that's really straight from the substrate. But if you go deep enough, you can catalyze memories and so forth, even from past life, and that again can give rise to ruminations. And often when we feel the ruminations are coming out of the blue, so to speak, I don't know where that came from, I think the Buddhist understanding would be, well, that just came from a dimension that you're not presently aware of. But there are layers and layers upon activity. So there it is. We just have to deal with it. And you can either simply continue releasing the rumination all the way through, which is the method for mindfulness of breathing, settling the mind, be lucidly ruminating, that is allowing the thoughts to arise, but in the bright, bright headlights of awareness. And then especially if we follow Nipenchen Rinpoche in his teachings on Mahamudra and the Shamatha within the context of Mahamudra, then when he goes into the awareness of awareness, he gives two options. And I think it's very nice. I've a number of people I'm training in long-term meditation, they found this really very inviting. And that is when you're resting that awareness of awareness, you've got two options. And one of these, as soon as you see the little head, the furry top of some little rumination coming up, just cut it right off. You're not doing any, there's no harm here, there's not a sentient being. As soon as you come up, just cut it. Almost like a nice one without getting really bloody with, guillotine and all of that, but the groundskeeper for the greens in a golf course, if he sees one little blade that's up too high, don't want you messing with the golf balls here, like that, right? No, with a broadsword. So as soon as you see a little blade of some rumination come up, beep, beep, like that, really, like that. That's a possibility. Just cut them off as soon as you see them. But don't make a big deal out of it. Just like that. A little sharp staccato. Like that. Because they haven't really come lunged up and grabbed you yet. They've just poked their head up, so give them a haircut. Give them a flat top. So that's one possibility. And the other possibility is, while resting there, right in the awareness of awareness, if some rumination comes up, allow it to arise. But don't go there. In other words, it's like, so you got neighbors making noise? Okay, make noise, but I'm not going there. So you don't need to do anything, and they'll just fade out of their own accord. They're definitely out on the hinterland, out on the periphery awareness. So you don't do anything about them. You let them rise, let them pass. But you don't, you're not venturing into settling the mind in its natural state, now really attending to them, observing them arise and pass. You say, well, if you want to rise in the neighborhood, you're welcome to do that. But sorry, I'm just going to have to ignore you because I've got a full-time job here, awareness of awareness. So those are the two basic strategies. Okay? Then carries from that. Good. Oh, Lasso. Anybody on the right? Anything coming up? We'll start with Kathy.
I may have missed some of your explanation, but I'm not clear what you mean by releasing from awareness of awareness. Is that what means? Or
I did say releasing, but I've never said releasing from awareness of awareness.
Okay. So what did you mean by release?
In this last practice,
meditation?
Last practice, yeah. By the way, if you want to know where this comes from, it's about Mazimbaba, natural liberation. It's his culminating shamatha practice, and he starts really easy. I mean, he starts in the shallow end of the pool, and he said, "Put a stick, stone, or flower in front of you and look at it." I can do it, you know. So it's really nice, really sweet. Will that take you all the way to shamatha? No way. But can you get your mind to stabilize a little bit? Okay, got it. So he starts really, really coarse, and then he winds up awareness of awareness. And when he comes to that one, he said, okay, now just stay here until you achieve shamatha. Right. And then the next chapter is vipassana. So, in that regard, he's the one that teaches this inversion. There are others as well, but he's classic. And where you're inverting your awareness in upon awareness, then releasing, inverting. But when I just say Padmasambhava's words, invert your awareness right in upon itself, people wonder, where am I going? I mean, where am I going to? Inside my head? Shall I go cross-eyed? Or go into my heart? Or where the heck am I supposed to go? Inverting from what? You know? And that's a good question. And so then I need to come up with an answer to give people, because people need a strategy. You can't just say invert it and then they're not knowing how what to do. And so if we consider, well, what are we inverting from? Well, we're going to stop doing what we have been doing, and that is what we normally do, is attend to appearances. That's what I'm doing right now. I'm looking over in your direction. I'm looking at you. So, in other words, imagine that I'm a one-horned snail. Okay? I got in a fight with a snail, but he nipped off the other bud. What can I say? You know? And so, normally, my little tentacle's going here, and, hi, Jordan, and hi there, Natu. Hi, Miles. You know, it's going extending in all different directions. You know, visual, auditory, tactile, mental, and so forth. So my little tentacle, you know, going all different directions. And this one is just pull it in. And that is pull in from all appearances. Withdraw from all appearances. And that's all six doors. Pulling in from even the space of the mind, of course from thoughts, of course from the sensory. Just, I'm no longer interested in any of you for the time being. And I'm withdrawing from all appearances, and I'm going to see what's left when I'm not attending to any appearances whatsoever, and what's left is what was already there. And that's just the awareness of awareness. Okay? So that's releasing all appearances, which means a withdrawal from all appearances, which, of course, what we're seeking to do here is emulate what takes place as we're falling asleep, but we're seeking to do that lucidly. Because when we fall asleep, the awareness does withdraw from all appearances. When you go deep asleep, it even withdraws from the appearances of the mind. But it's non-lucid, so we just go. So we slip into the substrate, the substrate consciousness, and the substrate consciousness slips right into the substrate, and then we don't know anything. But we have withdrawn from all appearances. Right? So we're trying to emulate the falling asleep process, emulate the dying process, but doing it lucidly. Is that clear? And then when you release, this is a bit easier to conceptualize. You're releasing, but you're not releasing out to a target, like the blueness of the sky or any other target. You're just going, whew. But with a caveat, don't just space out, but while holding the slender thread of the awareness of awareness. Okay? Clear?
And then you said the word you said the word oscillate.
Yes.
What was that?
Yeah. For a while I used the image of a pendulum, but I don't use it anymore because it's linear. A pendulum goes like this, back and forth, back and forth. We don't want that one. Because it's not going out in front of you and then inside and then outside. That's not a good image. It's a misleading image. It would be more like, if we want an image to, again, as a metaphor, it would be like a sea anemone. A sea anemone. Just releasing into space, but three-dimensionally, 360 degrees, just, and then, like all the light being sucked into a black hole, okay, from all directions, just into itself. And the oscillation is just that. Like in astronomy, it's something called a quasar, and they pulse. Okay, so this is kind of like a pulsing, like. That's the oscillation. Okay, and easy one would be like a balloon expanding, contracting, or the universe expanding, contracting, like that.
So should we be feeling some kind of oscillation in that?
I shouldn't try to feel anything other than what I've just said, and that is just doing what I've just said. It's not tactile, and it's just that release and the withdrawal objectless space and then withdrawal right into awareness, withdrawing from all appearances. And the oscillation just means expanding, contracting, expanding, contracting. That's all it means. And then you can set your own rhythm. Now, Padmasambhava doesn't say anything about how fast. Should it be 5 seconds in, 5 seconds out? So again, when I've taught this to people who've never done it, once again, they can just find it so novel, so new, so, how do you say, difficult, that they need something to hold on to. Give me some point of reference here that I'm familiar with, because I don't know how to do this at all. They say, okay, when you're breathing out, release. When you're breathing in, withdraw your awareness in upon itself, which means you're multitasking. But then you're multitasking when you count breaths, too. So it's a preliminary exercise. When you're breathing out, just. And then when you just feel that breath naturally flowing in, then draw your awareness right in upon itself. So for a while, to get the hang of it, you can conjoin the rhythm of the release and the withdrawal with the breathing. And then when you get the hang of it, then don't multitask anymore. Release the breath, and then just do it at your own pace, whether it's 20 seconds out, 20 seconds in, or 5 seconds, do it at your own pace. Okay? And part of this, just do it more. Just practice a bit more. We've only done it for a couple of days.
Okay. And once you get there, once you get to the point of awareness, you just stay there, you rest there.
Yeah, the Padmasambhava teaches this for two reasons. And he says so it's not my interpretation. And that is, in fact, in this particular discussion, he makes no reference to introspection at all, which is really part and parcel of shamatha practice. But he doesn't mention it. What he does say is that when you're doing this inversion and this release, the very fact of the releasing, that total, like, totally letting go, that just takes all the energy out of, or releases all the energy underlying excitation. Dissipating into space. But then, when you're withdrawing, you're not just withdrawing into your nose, or your kneecap, or even into a mental image. You're withdrawing right into the nature of awareness, which is by nature luminous. So you're converging right into luminosity. So you don't need to add clarity to that. You're converging where clarity emerges from. So the point there is, when you're inverting your awareness, that is a natural antidote to laxity. And when you release your awareness, that's a natural antidote to excitation. So with every oscillation, with every cycle, you're overcoming laxity and excitation. Now, it's exactly in this phase of the practice, where you're coming right in upon the agent, right in upon the observer, when you're doing that, he said, when you're doing this, he said, you may actually identify Rigpa. You may actually identify Rikva, pristine awareness, Dharmakaya, Buddha nature. You know, it's possible. So again, just like Dujum Lingpa says, you know, if you're a person of, actually said medium faculties. I think I said sharp before. He actually said medium faculties. If you're medium faculties and you just rest your awareness in space for 3 weeks, you may come out of Vidyadhara. Right? Come out, you know, realization of Rikpa. That's medium faculties. Then you must be wondering, well, how about sharp faculties? And the sharp faculties is you just hear the instructions and you become Vidyadhara. You know, like Sariputra. Ye dharma hetu prabhava. You know, he just heard that simple verse. He just heard the teachings. That was enough. He realized emptiness just by hearing about causality. You know, so he was very one right guy. So that it's called, Dujun Nimu calls it a simultaneous individual. A simultaneous individual. Those are the people with sharp faculties. That is, they hear the teaching and they get it. Boom. So if you're not quite that sharp, then I said, okay, now go off into solitude, rest your awareness in space for 3 weeks, and then maybe you'll realize Rikpa. If not, okay, then you go back to the gradual, step by step. Okay? So, likewise, this practice for the person of pretty sharp faculties, while it's designed as a shamatha practice to help your mind settle in its natural state, dissolve into the substrate consciousness, that's what it's designed to do. If you're a person of very sharp, you know, at least moderately sharp, medium, whatever, pretty gifted person, that practice there, right there, may be sufficient for realizing Rikpa. And if you realize Rikpa, as I emphasized this morning, if you realize Rikpa, then you don't need to do something separate in addition to realizing emptiness. Right? Just as if you're very lucid in a dream, you really know you're dreaming, then you don't need to learn something else to recognize the fact that there's no one really there from their own side. Because that's just part of being awake in the dream. That you must know that. Otherwise, you don't know that you're dreaming. If you still think that's a real person over there from their own side, and that's a real mountain over there made of molecules, if you still think that, then you're not lucid. If you are lucid, if you recognize the dream as the dream, then you are already realizing the emptiness of yourself as the persona in the dream, and the landscape and the people and so forth in it. Right? So, that's that. There was one other point. I'll just sit for just a sec, see if I can come up with it. No, that will do. That'll do. Good. Let's read one. This is from Frank. Oh, when I do awareness of awareness with you, I feel like I get a fair. I get it fairly strongly. But when I get back to my room and I lose it, no traction, spinning my wheels, feel like I'm wasting a lot of time. What to do? I know part of the answer, relax more deeply. If in doubt, yeah, that's always my answer. Except if the question is, when I meditate, I just get really, really dull. Then the answer isn't relax more deeply. So, no, it's a good question, and I'm sure you're not alone there. And this is why we have all of these steps. It's like taking you from the shallow end of the pool right into the deep of the pool. This is the deep end of the pool. This awareness of awareness. That's the deep end of the pool, right? And so, but I'll tell you the, okay, if that's just a little bit over your head and you don't quite know how to swim yet, it's kind of going glub, 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 because you're just not getting any traction. There it is. It's deeper than where you are. Then take a step back, just towards the shallow end of the pool. Just take a couple of steps back and see, okay, do you get traction here? And that is when you're settling the mind in this natural state and you take a special interest in the intervals between the thoughts, you're attending to that space of the mind. Can you sustain a flow of knowing, or have you just gone blank, just waiting, not getting anything? Can you be attending to the space of the mind and maintain a flow of knowing? If you can, that's right next door. That's right now. That's something. That's not so easy. That's pretty deep end of the pool. But if you can ascertain that and know something there, such that you can actually pose questions about that space of the mind and by attending closely get an answer. For example, is it flat? The space of the mind, is it flat? Is it a screen? Two-dimensional? Or is it three-dimensional? That's a reasonable question. Is it black? Or does it have any color at all? Is it small? Is it like a television set 3 meters in front of you? Or is it big screen? Or is it? I think I was in a kid. I think they had at least one cinema in Hollywood that it was 360 degrees. I think so. Yeah. You look in all directions, see it all around you like that. So is that the case? You know, is it all around? So if you can pose these questions and get answers by attending closely, then you are maintaining a flow of knowing. That's pretty darn close. So if you're there and you're attending the space of the mind and you're knowing it, then if you release a little bit of effort, and the effort is your one horn of your snail that was looking at the space of the mind and getting it, that's a pretty sensitive little antenna there. And then, I'm tired. And pull in. That is space of the mind. You've had your time. I'm no longer interested. Bye. And see what's left. And what's left was something that was already there. You already knew you were aware. That's not something new. It's unveiling something old. Okay? Jolly good. Okay? Anybody on this side? Yes, over to you, Danny.
So a follow-up to that question. I actually had the same question, so I'm glad it was asked.
You're referring to whom?
To the one about the oscillating.
The oscillation, yes, from Kathy.
So experientially, is the sense of that oscillation sort of similar to, let's say, Tong Len, where there's a sense of kind of, you know, pulling something in and then sending something out?
No.
Is it?
No, it's not. No, it's not. The Tong Len, in a very benign way, is saturated by grasping. Benign way, beneficial way. But it is grasping. Because I'm attending to this person. I'm bringing this person to mind. This person is another person than myself. And I'm sending light out to that person, and I'm drawing darkness in upon myself. And so it's filled with imagery. It's filled with an I-thou relationship, I-you relationship. So, and it's very skillful means, but it's saturated by grasping. Right? This practice is not a matter of sending out, but releasing. So sending out is what you do when you throw rice, right? And this release is what the little girl does when she releases the balloons. That's not sending anything. That's just, it's not going, it's just going, doesn't go anywhere. Just releasing. That's why it doesn't go for a while and then go and then dissipate. It just goes into space and releases. So there's no sending out. It's just release. And then the inversion is not drawing in anything. It's actually another kind of release. And that is, right now it's taking me some effort to direct my attention all the way over to you. Okay, like, oh, there you are, way over there. Okay. Like an old turtle going. Take some effort, right? But when you're withdrawing your awareness from all appearance, it's releasing that effort. Because now I'm having to know two things. I'm having to know you, but in knowing you, I already know that I'm aware. So I'm knowing two things. All right, that's just a bit too complicated for me. I'm going to release my knowing of you. It's more effortless. So I'm not drawing anything in. I'm releasing the extension. I'm releasing the effort of going out. So it's just kind of release and release and release and release. Effortless, effortless, effortless. Among the various methods of shamatha, and there's a wide variety, this is the one that is really the most unadulterated discovery approach to shamatha that I think that there is. I think you probably heard me use this model before, and it's quite useful for many people. But in a standard kind of a Gelugpa model, and it's classic, it's not just Gelugpa, it's all over Tibetan Buddhism. But we're really trying to develop qualities of attention that we don't have. We don't have the ability to sustain the attention on anything for more than a few seconds. So we're trying to develop that which wasn't there. And then when we try to visualize a Buddha image, we do not have clarity. And so we try to develop that which isn't there. A nice, clear, crystal clear, three-dimensional, radiant, high-definition image of the Buddha. We don't have that. So we try to develop it, and it's not there, right? And so that's very developmental. And it's a marvelous method. For many people, it's worked extremely well. Developing that which was not there, the stability, the vividness, and so forth. Here, it's really not a matter of developing anything, really. Because awareness, when it's free of grasping, is by nature still. That which makes it restless, agitated, excited, ruminating, and so forth, it's just grasping. That's what jerks it all over the place. It's grasping. And so here we are in both modes, releasing into objectless space, which means no grasping, and then inverting from all awareness, resting awareness in its own nature. That's no grasping. So it's doing two modalities of non-grasping. Right? And both of these are entail a releasing of effort, which itself, you know, would be a releasing of grasping. Grasping and effort are very closely related. So this is not so much, really it's not a matter of developing vividness and stability. It's rather releasing all grasping so that you discover the natural stillness of your own awareness. And then by releasing all that obscures the natural luminosity of your own awareness, you discover clarity. And so it's discovering stability and discovering clarity, which are innate qualities of your own awareness. In other words, it's discovering shamatha that was already there. Something like that. And once again, there was a little bit more, but it kind of just teased me and then went away. Yeah, that'll do. Okay? Good. Let's read one. From Francesca. There she is. Okay. Could you please clarify the following questions? All javana. All activities of the mind, memories, imaginations, ruminations, five sensory perceptions. Good, nice list. All javana arise from and dissolve into the substrate. Of course, if we wanted to keep this really homogenous, then we'd say bhavanga. Okay? But since I'm saying they're identical, that will be our working hypothesis until somebody shows me I'm wrong. So they arise from, dissolve into the substrate. Now, we should say this. Substrate consciousness, that's what you said. They arise from and dissolve into substrate consciousness, while thoughts appearances dissolve into the substrate. Yeah, now depending on what you mean by the word thought. So what I mean by the word thought is this discursive chit-chat, like overhearing a conversation, the appearances of sounds, of words, of conversations, commentary, and so forth in the mind. That's what I'm referring to. Something you can actually attend to as if you're listening with your mental ear. That's a mental appearance arising to you. Likewise, seeing mental imagery of colors and shapes, or mountains, landscapes, or, again, appearances of tastes, of smells, and so forth. So yes, I'm saying those objective appearances, they arise from and dissolve into the substrate, where your subjective mental processes, the mental impulses arising from and dissolving into the substrate consciousness. Are thoughts and appearances different from other activities of the mind? Why are they not included among the javana? Acha. Oh, they're completely conjoined with javana. They're completely conjoined with javana. They're simply kind of the objective pole of javana. So they probably are javana, because javana is referring to the activities of the mind. All right, so they're linked. Just like there's no one who is informed without there being something about which you're informed. There are no thoughts. There are no appearances of thoughts without some subjective awareness, whether it's explicit or implicit. So the two are entangled all the way through. Okay? So javana is a whole system. And moreover, this is where it's a bit simpler to keep with homogenous vocabulary. And that is Theravada, they don't speak of the alaya. They don't even have a word for it. Or the alaya vijnana, no word for that either. Just bhavanga. All javana arising from bhavanga. So they're just taking that substrate consciousness as one unified system. Okay? And that's pretty much what Gurupis will do too. They don't talk about alaya and alaya vijnana. They talk about subtle continuum mental consciousness. So then we say those appearances and all of that, they arise from that dimension. Aren't all javana appearances to the mind too? In a manner of speaking, yes. And that is, When you're aware of an emotion arising, aware of a desire arising, are those not appearances? Yes, they are. Of course they are. They are objects of awareness. You know them. You know that you're feeling upset, you're angry, you're happy, you're content. You know that. How do you know that? By way of some experience of feeling content or what have you. So it is an appearance. But my point here is that our awareness of these subjective impulses, and these are the semjung, that which is arising from sem, from the mind, that our awareness of them is always retrospective. Just like awareness of awareness itself. So this is a point, and this is where the teachings on awareness of awareness are completely compatible with prasangika madhyamaka. Otherwise Shantideva, you know, wouldn't accept it, Tsongkhapa wouldn't accept it. But they do. Tsongkhapa very explicitly acknowledges, yes, awareness of awareness. Resting in the sheer luminosity and sheer cognizance of awareness. That is the shamatha practice. He tips his hat to it, moves it right along. And so when you're aware of awareness, is it one pulse, one moment of awareness knowing itself? The answer is no. Not in prasanga. And I think, once again, I think they're right. No, it's retrospective. If these two fingers were two adjacent jazoki kechigma, and that is pulses of cognition that actually ascertain something, so maybe it's 50 milliseconds, so a cluster of those extremely brief moments, but clustering all in upon the same object. So if I got one cluster here of 50 milliseconds of mental awareness, and then in the next moment there's another 50 millisecond cluster, and they're both of mental awareness, and they're both inverted right in upon awareness of awareness, the second finger is ascertaining the first finger. And the third finger is ascertaining the second finger. And the fourth finger is ascertaining the third finger. So each one is getting the immediate preceding one. And since they're so similar, because they're all looking at the same flow of cognition, and since the cognition isn't going out to shapes, colors, sounds, and smells, and so forth, but it's just maintaining in samadhi a unified flow of awareness, of awareness, of awareness, of awareness, then it's quite smooth, quite homogeneous. That is, what you're aware of seems to be just, I'm just sitting here being aware of being aware of being aware. It's just a smooth continuum, an ongoing flow of luminosity and cognizance, and it really seems to be the same flow, like just the same stream, quite homogeneous. And that's true, because each moment is so similar to its predecessor, because each one is looking over its shoulder at the preceding one. So as that is, I think, the clearest and most precise analysis, it's kind of a philosophical conceptualization of what actually happening when we try to make sense of awareness, as that's what occurs when you're practicing awareness of awareness. Likewise, when you're aware of, I'm feeling quite content, that experience, the appearance of feeling content is retrospective. So it's just looking over its shoulder at a subjective impulse of feeling content, or angry, or agitated, or what have you. So yes, there are appearances, but here's the point of difference, and that is when we are aware of the appearances of the immediately preceding moment of some subjective experience or mental process, that is retrospective, right? Whereas I would say, with a lot of confidence actually, that when I visualize an image, let's say, of my mother, the appearance of that image and my awareness of it are completely simultaneous. That is, the image wasn't there for 50 milliseconds and then my attention got caught up to it. It's not retrospective. They're actually right there, exactly simultaneous. And likewise, the sounds that I hear mentally, when I'm in a dream, the appearances arising to my awareness and my awareness of them, I would say simultaneous. So that's it. It's a bit different. Which then, I mean, when we're really going to really subtle vipassana in the nature of this, then more questions can be raised that are rather interesting. And that is there any difference in impact when you are aware of an objective appearance, like a mental image, when you're aware of a mental image arising in your mind, does that awareness of it, that attentiveness to it, does that have any different impact on what you're aware of than when you direct your awareness in upon a subjective impulse? Do they affect that which you're attending to in any different way? So, for example, you can be, remember the song, who was it? I'm so glad, I'm so glad, I'm glad, I'm glad, I'm glad. Who is it? I'm so glad, I'm so glad, I'm glad, I'm glad, I'm glad. This is, you don't remember? But you remember who they, you remember the song, right? Late 60s. Well, Cream, there we go. Oh, he got Cream. It's a Cream, yeah, you got it. Yeah. Some of his neurons haven't burned off. But there it is. It's so nicely phrased. I'm glad, I'm glad, I'm glad, I'm glad. This guy is just resting in the flow of being aware of being aware of being aware. And it's glad. And clearly, he's glad that he's glad, because that's what keeps it going. You know? Whereas, if you're enjoying some food, and then you invert your awareness right in upon the enjoyment that's arising, you may find that that just breaks the flow. Therapeutically, this can be very interesting. If you're depressed, and you kind of suddenly get just instead of just not liking being depressed, you say, "Oh, the heck with it! Why don't I just see what it's like?" And you invert your awareness like a probe, to come right into the experience of being depressed. You may find it just evaporates. Not that it's healed, solved, and you're free forever, but you might just find that by probing right into, like with a sharp fork, into the muffin of depression. It just deflates, you know. Oh, yeah. Thank goodness they're getting this all on video. People in future generations will definitely want these incredible words of profundity. Yep. So good. Now we have one from the... Yes, go ahead. Natu.
When we do awareness of awareness,
yep.
When I do the oscillation and I analyze the nature of my awareness at that, when I'm the awareness is out in space or when it comes back in
right.
on itself, I just see, for me, I see the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Awareness, it's the same thing.
Yeah.
For me. Anyway, even if I say, "Oh, am I doing this or not?" I have the feeling it's the same. But when we finally release the oscillation, or when we do awareness of awareness, where we stretch in all directions, and we release that, and we
come back to the center.
There's something about awareness that seems to have a home. That when we finish all of this, mm-hmm. then it just doesn't move. It stays there. It's perfect.
Right.
Why is it so? What is it about it that, and even the third awareness of awareness, when we bring it to the heart, we move it from. It seems to have a home somewhere, a place where it's. Anyway, I don't.
No, it's good. And when you, she's referring to something that I know you've heard from the podcast, and I've taught it many times in all of the preceding 8-week retreats here, and I've not taught it here, and I don't think I will. So that was just the culminating phase of this sequence from Padmasambhava, where you're extending above, below, and so forth. So we won't do that in this series. But just one question for you, because in that sequence, of course, as you remember, you come into the heart and then you just go supernova, right, out into space. When you let your awareness, and as much as possible, let the actual locus of awareness, not the object of awareness, but the locus of awareness, as if you're stepping into an elevator and just going down a couple of floors. And so you're actually just resting in the heart chakra. Do you feel there that you're home, or do you feel that you've extended someplace else?
Home.
Yeah. So good. All of this is good. All of it's fine. And...
It's a question.
I know it is.
Why is it like that? Why do we stretch it, and why, when we release the stretching, why does it just stay?
So that when you come home, you know it. We find the middle way by finding that which isn't the middle way. And then we find that there's... So when we come to some realization of the emptiness of an autonomous, controlling ego, that's something of a middle way. But then is there a more slender middle way? The answer is yeah. Let's go into Madhyamaka. And then is there something... And so the middle way gets narrower and narrower and narrower, right? In a way that you're bouncing off fewer extremes. And so likewise, when we're normally just caught up in ordinary awareness, the attention is going all over the place. And then when we relax, we fall asleep. Right? And so here in this exercise, you're, well, you're doing the oscillation, like so, and then just kind of like stretching. Give me some elbow room here. To the right as far as you can go, to the left as far as you can go, up and down. And you've already done in and out. And so when you've done all of that, and you've done all these exercises, because like working out in the, you know, the psycho gym, when you've, having extended yourself in these kind of subtle ways, and then you release all that effort of extending anywhere, all the effort of going even into space, all the effort of inverting into awareness itself, all of this quite contrived. It is. It's zunche. Zunche. Jumare. Jumare. It's contrived. It's something you have to make happen. It doesn't happen all by itself. So you realize that which is jume, uncontrived. Zume, effortless. When you have extended your contrivances, your imaginations, your extensions, your efforts, and having done that, you can see now that you've done that, now what's it like when you release that? You say, oh, that's home. So you find home by extending yourself in different directions away from home, and then seeing what it's like to release all of that. And then you see, aha, this is not one more thing to do. I think that's a nice way of phrasing it. Everything else was something to do. Do this, do that, do this, do that. And then finally, you mean this is not doing. So it's our closest approximation within this relative framework. Our closest approximation to Rigpa. It's not Rigpa, but it's a good preparation. Because you've probably heard in when you're authentically practicing texture, you've identified Rigpa authentically, and you're resting there, two phrases come up. Jame, jadel. Like jadel rinpoche. Jadel rinpoche, right? Well, of course, you speak Tibetan. Ja means activity. Del means free of, disengage from. Jame means no activity, absence of activity. And so once your awareness has now come to rest in its ground, ji rigpa, in the ground awareness, then you're absolutely doing nothing. You're absolutely doing nothing. Which is to say that you're not activating at all your conventional sense of who you are. Not even your, let alone delusional, like the CEO of the company, or let alone delusional as I'm inherently existent. Let alone that. Even conventionally, are you a sentient being or not? That's you know, to be a sentient being is not to say something wrong. I mean, if you're a sentient being, you're a sentient being, right? If you're a woman, you're a woman, right? But now even that innocent little statement, I'm a sentient being, even that's being deactivated. So even a conventional truth is being deactivated. Jame, jade, dogme, dupe yule deba. Transcending all conceptual elaborations, right? So that's the ultimate stillness. And when you're there, there is absolutely nothing to be done, right? Absolutely nothing. So we can't simply choose to go there. That's why we have these steps. But this is a good approximation for that, that we're resting there, doing nothing, but we do nothing by these various subtler and subtler doings. Until when we release the doing, then what's left over is just resting. Shep kara rigpa rangsar neba. Rigpa, or now just awareness, just ordinary consciousness, but awareness resting in its own place. Rangsar zimba, holding its own ground. Right. So it's our approximation of dzogchen. Okay? And what this is, while when you are resting in rigpa, as in pristine awareness, you've completely deactivated everything about you that is a sentient being. Completely deactivated. Therefore, if you do anything to achieve enlightenment, you're going in the opposite direction. Right? So there's really absolutely nothing to be done. Right? And here, in this practice, this little old shamatha practice, we're deactivating completely the coarse mind. Completely deactivating it. That is, we're not going to any of the physical senses. That's coarse mind. But we're not activating any of the javana of the coarse mind either, not attending to appearances or subjective mental processes. we're deactivating it all and just resting in relatively naked. Relatively, simply because it's not rikpa rikpa, but relatively naked, just the flow of mental awareness, unadorned by the desire realm, unadorned, unelaborated by the coarse mind, just resting there. So ending, I think this is a long one, so I'm going to wait for tomorrow on that one. But there's an image I like, and it comes right back to the earlier point of if you're focusing on a Buddha image, then you're really achieving shamatha. And for some people, that's just the best way to do it. It's absolutely authentic. Tsongkhapa taught it multiple times, and so did Kamachame Rinpoche, and so did Guru Rinpoche, Padmasambhava. It's not a sectarian deal. It's not Lupas versus Nyingmapas. No, not true. Both of them teach all of it. They all teach all of it. It's within the schools of Tibetan Buddhism. I kind of just immerse myself in that for a moment. I have to pull myself out of it. Oh, yeah. So all the schools say there's a legitimate, very effective method for achieving shamatha, developing stability and vividness. Focus on Buddha image. Could be self-generation. Then you do it by way of Vajrayana. But it's development by gum. Get rim. You're definitely getting something, generating, developing something, right? But now in this practice, there's nothing to develop and there's nothing to generate. And so the image that I like is taking a... imagine you go to your potbelly stove, which has coal in it, coal, and it's red hot, just red hot, right? You take one of those red hot glowing embers of coal out of your potbelly stove and you go outside to a mound of snow and you put that glowing ember right on the top of it. Release it and stand back. What does the glowing ember have to do to achieve the substrate consciousness? Nothing. Just shine on. And just melt your way down, all the way down. Until there's nowhere to go. So you just release and let the locus of your awareness just melt its way through until it comes to its ground. Substrate consciousness. And then you're in your relative home. You're in your samsara home. Like if every lifetime is a yo-yo, we into human, we into deva, we into etc. And back to the palm is your substrate consciousness. And then all the other ones are short stories. Even if it's, you know, formless realm for 3 eons, it's called this sleeper, you know. But if, sooner or later it comes back to the palm. And so you're home in samsara that you keep on coming back to like a homing pigeon as you fly out into all the 6 realms of existence. The home you keep on coming back to is your substrate consciousness. So conventionally speaking, it'd be really quite natural and easy to identify, well, at least, okay, I'm really a sentient being. This is who I really am. I take on the role of being a human being, a role of being this, that, and the other thing. But when I'm unveiled, when I've slipped out of all my roles, then I'm just a sentient being. And my nature is substrate consciousness. And I've got a whole bunch of karma and mental afflictions, and that's who I really am. Okay. So that's your home in samsara. And then you blow up your home. blow the basement out of your home. And see, that's just one more construct. And then you drop in to the jirgva, which is really the foundation, which is then beautifully stated, kadasavane. It's the ground of samsara and nirvana. Now that's home. And that's so home, that's even outside of time. Because when you're resting in the home of your substrate consciousness, that's in time. No beginning, no end, perhaps. But it's still in time. Whereas when you break through that to rikpa, well, that's home outside of space and outside of time. So that's really all. Okay. Good. Enjoy your dinner.